Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, online at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, Florida's cracker culture.
These days, if you're a cracker, you wear that as a matter of pride and with great honor.
We'll discuss Florida's second Spanish period.
Everybody wanted to take Florida. From the beginning, they didn't like the idea that the Spaniards were there.
And we'll talk about abandoned vehicles of the Everglades. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers.
His beard may be stubble like a cut over sugar cane field. His clothes may be dirty, but the look in his eyes lets you know he won't yield. He's from a breed that has died, but he has survived, and the world he once knew is gone. He's an old cracker cowman, existing a long way from home.
What does it mean when someone is called a Florida cracker? Many believe that the term refers to pioneer cowmen cracking their whips. Others think that the name Florida cracker comes from the practice of cracking corn to create dietary staples of early settlers.
Jimmy crack corn and I don't care. Jimmy crack corn and I don't care. Jimmy crack corn and I don't care. My master's gone away.
It's also possible that William Shakespeare created the word cracker in his play King John from the 1590s.
What cracker is this? The same that deafs our ears with this abundance of superfluous breath.
Whatever its origin, the term Florida cracker is used both positively and negatively. In its broadest sense, Florida cracker is the name for pioneer settlers and their descendants. These pioneers were mostly of Scotch-Irish heritage and first arrived in the 18th and early 19th centuries. Dana St. Clair is author of the book Cracker, The Cracker Culture in Florida History.
We know that the word itself is very old. It's 16th century Old English. Cracker had an extra E in there. But it was a term that the British Crown and the Spanish Crown used to describe these rogue white settlers in Florida and the Southeast. And we actually have historical documents that describe these people as crakers. The word goes way back, though. Even Will Shakespeare used it. And if I can remember it, I think it was King John, the play, where he said, "What craker is this that deafs our ears with this abundance of superfluous breath," which is a nice way, of course, of saying somebody was full of hot air.
The term cracker, when students, teachers, parents hear it, more than half, you can see their eyes light up and their eyebrows will raise, because unfortunately it has become a derogatory term in the past.
Kara Hoblick is executive director of the Florida Agricultural Museum in Palm Coast.
But that's part of the education here, is that we explain the process of how the cracker term came about. And the pride. Florida crackers are very proud that they are Florida crackers, and it is a way of life, a heritage that has gone through many years and developed over time.
The earliest documented usage of the word cracker refers to a braggart, a boaster, and a lover of tall tales of Scotch-Irish descent. The term evolved to include unauthorized white settlers who came to Florida before it was named a United States territory in 1821. Dana St. Clair.
By the time the Spanish and the British were settling Florida, it became known as a word to describe these rogue white settlers who paid no attention to the authority of the crown. They would tell them where to live and they wouldn't live there, and they would tell them they couldn't live in a place and they would. And we have letters going back and forth to the Spanish and the British crown describing that.
The independent spirit of the Crackers came from their Scotch-Irish roots. Escaping war, poverty, and religious oppression in the 1700s, they emigrated to the Carolinas and Georgia, with some making their way down into Florida. From inside the Clark Homestead at the Florida Agricultural Museum, Kara Hoblick says that the life of a Florida cracker was challenging.
Daily life, just like in this house, 1880, everything the family did, and it was the mom, the dad, and the children, from the minute they woke up until the minute they went to bed, they worked. They worked here on the farm. And anything they ate or wore or used, they produced themselves. The only way that they would raise money was through sugarcane grinding and selling sugarcane syrup. So if they needed something that they could not make, like bricks or something, they would store up the syrup, take it to town, and that was a big day to go to town and either trade or sell their syrup.
They had the ability to settle and subsist in very, very challenging areas throughout the Southeast. And we know that the interior highlands were farmed. There were cracker fisher folk on the coast, and you know, down in the Keys, we call them the Conks. That was what a Key West cracker is. They figured out how to subsist very much like the Native Americans did. The Native Americans developed settlement patterns based on the resources that were available to them, generally food. And that includes the estuary resources, shellfish and fish. There were a lot of crackers that survived that way. But in the interior areas, they grew their own food. They made their own products. They built their own houses. They made their own clothes. So they were self-reliant, self-sufficient.
Florida's cracker cowmen, also called cow hunters, made the cattle industry the driving force of Florida's economy well into the 20th century. The state was the biggest supplier of beef to the Confederate Army during the Civil War. Florida's cattle industry can be traced all the way back to Spanish exploration in the 1500s. Sandra Wise is with Crescent J Ranch at Forever, Florida.
Well, it was on Ponce de Leon's second trip to the New World that he brought horses, actually, and cows. People are not sure of how well that went on that second trip, because some of the historical information has the cattle scattering as the Calusa, I believe, Indians were the ones that met him on that trip. So perhaps the leftovers of those cattle, many of them that ran wild and ended up with the Indians, was the beginning of what we have here now and as the Florida cracker horses. There are also stories that support DeSoto bringing cattle. But getting here, however they did, they're here now, the descendants of them. And we refer to them as cracker cattle. They're actually Spanish from Andalusia.
Cracker cattle, if we can call them that, what became the Andalusian cattle, were introduced by the Spanish. And Florida had a thriving cattle industry long before Texas and the Great West. But the cracker culture sort of shifted in the early 1800s. It was mainly due to the Arms Occupation Act in the early 1800s, which provided any settler with a certain amount of land. So it became prosperous. It became attractive to folks to start raising cattle and getting free land to do that.
A lack of fences on the open Florida range allowed unscrupulous cracker cowmen to overbrand stray cattle that didn't belong to them and claim new calves from other herds. Dana St. Clair.
Thousands and thousands of these cattle escape over fenceless ranges. And it was very popular for cracker cow hunters at one time to overbrand and collect rogue cattle. And Frederick Remington, when he wrote his article in the late 19th century, was utterly disappointed and wrote this fantastic, wonderful, disparaging piece in Harper's New Monthly magazine. And he was so incensed by what he saw. It wasn't the romanticized Western cowboy culture that he had just experienced. It was something radically different. But because he was so upset with the way that he was treated and what he saw, that he described it in meticulous detail. So it's one of the best ethnographic accounts that we have of the late 19th century cracker cow hunter and cowman culture.
In 1949, Florida became the last state to pass a mandatory fence law to keep individual cattle herds contained, effectively ending the practice of rebranding. While cracker cowmen no longer have to round up their cattle on the open range, the name cow hunter is still used. Kara Hoblick.
There were no fences. So the cowboys that would go out into the scrub to collect the cattle were actually called cow hunters, because they would go to hunt their cattle if they needed to come collect them for branding or to take them to market. And we do have heritage cracker cattle here. And there's associations that are extremely diligent about making sure that breed is pure. They will not add an animal to their registry unless it is documented and certified that it's a true cracker animal.
Sandra Wise of Crescent J Ranch at Forever, Florida.
Some of the history books refer to the what we call cracker cattle as like donkeys, in that they're very small, they're bony. Some of the information all says they're not very good for either beef or milk, but they're very hardy. They've got good immune systems, external parasites, internal parasites, and that's true of the horses too, the Florida cracker horses, which are of that Spanish bloodline.
Cracker culture still exists in Florida, but urban sprawl continues to threaten this rural way of life. Dana St. Clair.
The long arm of civilization is reaching into these areas, like southern Ocala, which is now the villages, used to be cracker country all the way down to Brooksville. I grew up there. I remember seeing that every time I took a trip that way. But they're disappearing.
Kara Hoblick.
To teach the Florida cracker heritage is so important because it's a way of life. It's very important to the many generations that have grown up in this area. There are some families here that have been here for five generations, and this is their family's history. This is a story that needs to be told. And that is one thing that the Florida Agriculture Museum, it's our mission to tell the story of Florida agriculture's past, present, and future. And the cracker is the past, it is the present. There are still many people still living the cracker lifestyle, and we need to continue that in the future too.
Dana St. Clair, author of the book Cracker, The Cracker Culture in Florida History.
These days, if you're a cracker, you wear that as a matter of pride and with great honor. It's not the term that it used to be. It happened somewhere around the time Jimmy Carter became president and the Southern culture started to emerge, and people were fascinated with it. But these days, crackers at least the ones that aren't terribly private, crackers are quick to tell you about their heritage, because it is that. It isn't just a description of a people, it's a description of their culture, and that's really what they embrace.
The population of Florida has been expanding exponentially since the mid-20th century. Cow pastures, farmland, and citrus groves are replaced with housing developments, shopping centers, and highways. Florida's cracker culture is being preserved, though, at places like the Pioneer Settlement for the Creative Arts in West Volusia County, Fort Christmas Historical Park in East Orange County, and at the Florida Agricultural Museum in Palm Coast.
And dirt bikes scream over land that used to be scrub cow trails. and interstate highways have taken the place of old Mr. Flagler's rails. And condos rise from the land and space shuttles fly. And the old cracker cowman don't know how it all passed him by.
This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Registration is now open for the Florida Historical Society Public History Forum to be held May 28th through 30th in Daytona Beach at the Shores Resort and Spa. More information is at myfloridahistory.org. During Florida's Second Spanish period from 1783 to 1821, several different groups dreamed of controlling the region. Sebastian Garcia has more.
In 1784, Spain regained control of Florida. They returned not as the great imperial power from centuries prior, but as an empire on the verge of collapse. Thus, their control of the peninsula was unstable and weak. This instability encouraged the ambitions of white American Southerners to expand their plantation system into the territory. Conversely, however, this instability also created the conditions for displaced Native Americans and runaway enslaved people to transform the area into a haven against the encroaching United States. In this excerpt from the Memory of Negro Four podcast, historians Nathaniel Millott, Matthew Clavin, and Jane Landers explain why Spanish Florida held such significance for white Southerners and Native and enslaved people alike during this period between the American Revolution and the War of 1812. Spanish Florida became such a crucial space for these groups that they shed blood and died for it during the Battle of Negro Fort in July 1816, only a few months after the War of 1812 concluded. Negro Fort's contemporary obscurity partly comes from the fact that it existed within the context of the War of 1812, a conflict equally overshadowed and misunderstood. The war meant more than Francis Scott Key's Defense of Fort McHenry poem, which later became the Star Spangled Banner, and the spectacle of the British incineration of Washington, D.C. It was a war that carried considerable ramifications for all combatants involved, including the westward and southward-looking Americans, the British, the Spanish, and the indigenous and black people who fought for their freedom. It was a war that led to the creation of the largest autonomous community of escaped enslaved people and Native Americans in the history of the United States.
The War of 1812 is still one of those things which is habitually understudied, always overshadowed by the American Revolution. The War of 1812 is intensely significant for multiple different reasons. My name is Nathaniel Millett. I'm an associate professor of history at St. Louis University. I'm also the editor of a journal called Atlantic Studies. American settlers, enslavers are kind of moving in to Alabama and Mississippi and in places like this that are in the proximity of Spanish Florida, but they're doing so while being kind of uneasy. They're moving in because they're greedy and they want to expand and they want land, but they're scared of Seminoles. They're scared of Creeks. They're scared of Red Sticks. They're scared of the kind of lingering British presence out of the Caribbean. And the War of 1812 to Southerners is a pristine opportunity to knock out the Spanish in Florida and to end this threat to the expansion of slavery.
Florida is just very much beauty in the eye of these Southern slave-owning, land-owning beholders. And they have these incredible visions and dreams of acquiring Florida, not only to extend their plantation culture, but to control the waterways. And they can ship their cotton through a lot of these bodies of water that stream from across the South into the Gulf of Mexico. And so there's just an economic component to this.
This dream came with a deep fear, however, of what Spanish Florida held, especially for the subjugated peoples of the United States, namely a non-Anglo, non-Protestant, multiracial, and multi-ethnic society that undermined the growing racial rigidity of the United States.
There's also this idea that Spanish Florida, it's non-Anglo, it's non-Protestant. There's such a great number of Native people, increasingly runaway slaves. And so this totally runs counter to, again, the dreams and visions of these Southern slave owners. And so this border is a place of fear and concern for Southern slave owners, and they want to not only secure the border, but ultimately eliminate it by making Florida a part of the United States.
To American slaveholders across the colonial and early national period, their single greatest fear is slave rebellion. And accordingly, white Southerners believe in the essential imperative nature of creating these acutely, rigidly hierarchical, racialized societies, which are also acutely patriarchal. I mean, a lot of power and control in the hands of prominent white men, enslavers, officials, militia leaders, oftentimes the same person in all three cases. And their job is to keep everyone in check, to keep enslaved people from undermining this, Native people as well, who are considered kind of transgressive and not quite fitting neatly in this hierarchy. Their freedom, their mobility, their autonomy in Native people, their willingness sometimes to work with, to shelter, to live with formerly enslaved Africans, but also to enslave and entrap down in Hunt is troubling to white Southerners. And then in turn, Spanish Florida kind of ties all of this up. It is a large place which is largely uncontrolled by imperial white authorities. It is a bastion for fugitive slaves. The society there, indigenous people and free and enslaved African people, have more autonomy than they do in an American, North American, Anglo-American plantation society. All of this seems like a dangerously bad example to people to the North. And white Southerners look at anything that might encourage disobedience, challenging this racialized hierarchy, as being dangerous. The young United States agrees by and large and looks at the challenge of Spanish Florida as almost a national security threat.
Everybody wanted to take Florida. From the beginning, they didn't like the idea that the Spaniards were there. I'm Zane Landers. I'm the Gertrude Conaway Vanderbilt Professor of History at Vanderbilt University. They used all sorts of derogatory language about them and so on, the Anglos to the north. I'm speaking of that expansionist mode that the Americans were committed to, get those Spanish papists, as they would call them, out of there. So everybody's trying to get the Spanish out. And Spain is weakened by this time. It's not the great imperial wealthy power it once was. It's spread thin, and it's experiencing revolutions against its monarchy too that will weaken it, which means it can't supply its colonies the way it used to. It can't enforce the law the way it used to. It can't defend. It can't do a lot of things. And that makes it more unstable too. It's in that turmoil that 1812 happens. Then you could say the Creek Wars happen. And then you could say Negro Ford happens, and that some of the same people are involved in all of those episodes, too.
An enslaved person named Polydor was one of several individuals whose life intersected with the events of the War of 1812, and by extension, Negro Ford. Initially enslaved at Andrew Jackson's Hermitage Plantation, Polydor escaped his bondage as a child by heading south to Spanish Florida. Like many enslaved blacks before him, Polydor saw a path within the Spanish system to secure his freedom that did not exist in the United States.
To learn more, please follow and listen to the first episode of the Memory of Negro Fort podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever else you get your podcast. For Florida Frontiers, I'm Sebastian Garcia, a graduate history student, FHS media production assistant, and history podcaster at the University of Central Florida, Department of History.
This is Florida Frontiers. Photographer Matt Stock and Everglades explorer Charles Kropke have created the coffee table size book, Abandoned Vehicles of the Everglades. The book contains artfully staged photographs of cars, vans, and even an airplane that were left in the Everglades as long as a century ago. Matt Stock introduced the book at the Miami Book Fair.
My partner in the book project, Charles J. Kropke, has been involved in Everglades and environmental preservation and tours, ecotours for decades. And in my own art practice as a photographer, I've been exploring the Everglades myself for over a decade. And first met Charles, and Charles said, have you ever photographed the abandoned vehicles of the Everglades? And I said, what abandoned vehicles? And that kind of launched this multi-year project, 85 expeditions out into the night in the Greater Everglades watershed, a Knight Foundation grant, and almost a decade later, here we are with the book.
Stock says that people are often surprised at how many vehicles have been abandoned in the Everglades, and that many of them have interesting stories.
In kind of tracing and looking for some of these vehicles, some of it speaks to the history of man's interaction with the Everglades. In fact, most of them do. So a lot of these vehicles are connected with old farms that had existed or homesteads that had existed before becoming national parks or national preserves out in the wetlands. Some of them were folks that owned cabins and recreated out there and would take these vehicles out, and then they're 15 miles out and they die and there's no way to tow them out of the sugar sand. So for example, kind of midway through the book, there is a Ford Model A that was converted into a swamp buggy with dually wheels that was put on it that was abandoned about 15 miles out now in the middle of nowhere. Some of them were connected with more nefarious things. There's a drug plane that we photographed. The tail numbers were on another fixed wing aircraft and they were transferred to this and it was abandoned in a prairie. Some of them have mysterious histories that we can't even trace. But it all deals with the idea that people have always been fascinated with the Everglades going back thousands of years. And since vehicles were invented, provided them a way to get out there. And sometimes those vehicles, again, had no way to get back home.
Matt Stock chose to photograph the abandoned vehicles at night, giving some of the images a haunting ambiance.
In my art practice, I'm what's called a light painter. So I am a night photographer. I go out with a team of assistants armed with different light sources, and I direct them like a composer would where to put those lights. So instead of a woods and a string section, I've got a rocks and a trees section. So I like to control the light. It creates more of a cinematic storytelling component. So that was really the impetus behind it, was to create this hyper-realistic, almost fairy tale-like quality to the images.
Photographer Matt Stock and Everglades explorer Charles Kropke have created the book Abandoned Vehicles of the Everglades. We spoke with Matt Stock at the Miami Book Fair. You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week. Until then, visit us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org and on Facebook at Florida Historical Society. Production assistance comes from Connie Lester and Sebastian Garcia. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.